Broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University, this is WSDL Ocean City, NPR News Talk 90.7, putting Delmarva first. It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
As the new year gets underway, one of the questions that many are asking is, what will the economic outlook be for 2014. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Maryland's economic recovery still has an unemployment rate hovering around 6.4%. The Delmarva region appears to be slowly coming back from the hit it took, especially in the construction industry. Take a look at these issues. Our in-studio guests are George Nichols. He is the Assistant Managing Director for Integra Realty Resources, and also Dr. Memo Dereker. He's head of the Business Economic and Community Outreach Network at Salisbury University, also president-elect of the Salisbury Area Chamber of Commerce. Welcome to you. Let me just, first of all, and I'm going to start with you, Memo. What does the economic outlook, and this is how you assess it, for this coming year? As I've read some of the literature and some of the reporting, some of the people who take a look at this, it's a bit mixed. People talk about steady growth, maybe 40, 50,000 jobs, maybe for the state in this coming year. What are you reading?
Well, at the state level, there are a couple of issues that we're dealing with. One is the continued problems we're having with the structural deficit. And given that our proximity to D.C. creates a lot of economic opportunity in good times, the fact that Washington is having some problems and they're talking about budget issues, the state's recovery is going to be on track, but it's not going to be stellar. It's going to be moderate. On the shore, it's going to be a little bit slower, and this has always been the case. We come into these recessions a little bit slower, and we get out a lot slower. In the next 3 months to 6 months, we don't expect a major change in the slow recovery we're going through right now. We're hoping, however, in the second half of the year, the third and fourth quarters, that the curve is going to go a little bit further upwards, and we're going to do a little bit better. Our unemployment rate, it's one of those jobless recoveries we're talking about. It is going to improve, especially in the second and third quarters, but not in major significant changes in unemployment.
Now, I understand that a lot of the elements for the surge, they sit around things like energy production, particularly, certainly out in the West. You've got industrial production, which seems to be picking up because of manufacturing going on, and then all agriculture production is coming up. How do those factors fit into where we are in terms of how they affect Maryland and then obviously the shore?
Particularly on the shore, the big impact of the recession has been in the real estate and construction industry, since that particular sector of the economy is beginning to show life. And my fellow guests here will be able to address that. We are hopeful. However, there still is a lot of inventory that has not been soaked up, particularly in the beach areas. And the construction is very slow coming. A lot of the jobs we lost there are not going to immediately come back. Some of the other areas where we're doing well, business services seem to be doing well. Retail is showing signs of improvement, even though we heard about the JCPenney closing. That's right. Has more to do with JCPenney than our market. At the state level, again, it comes back to what Washington does and what Annapolis does. There is going to be a breaking effect of those two phenomena there. Otherwise, we're doing well. All the leading indicators are positive, not very fast positive, but moderate growth positive.
Now, I watched, it was State Controller Peter Franchot, and he seemed to be very dire, very subdued. I mean, probably the darkest, I think, projection with income down, that kind of thing. How do you match what you see is going on with the kind of image and the kind of view that he takes?
Well, where he is sitting, he has every reason to be downcast, because he's looking at the state income coming in, the taxes, the fiscal situation. And until property prices significantly increase, until incomes increase, until jobs increase at a significant level, we're not going to be coming back to where we were in 2006, 2007 for a while yet. So from his perspective, also looking at the things we mentioned in Annapolis and Washington, he's right to think that. We are looking at it more from a private sector perspective. We're looking at it more of a aggregate what's going to happen here on the shore perspective. And even though our growth projections are very, very moderate, this is the first time in 7 years we're saying it's growth. So you have to look at it relatively. I call it the Einstein economy. It's all relative.
I want to turn to you, Georgia, because one of the things that strikes me is that the biggest sector that really took a real, real hit has been obviously construction. I mean, that is just, I mean, as I think I suggested the other day, some people say, you know, the construction industry had a recession and the rest of the country, we had a depression. And I can remember a whole series of major, major projects, thousands of residential homes that were supposed to be built. And then suddenly the recession hits and the whole thing sort of collapses. Where are we in terms of where we were, say, in 2009, 2010? I mean, is it picking up? What are we seeing?
We're seeing improvement all around. There's no question that we rely pretty heavily on construction on the shore to carry our economy. But I see a lot of positive signs, more and more development. Again, it's a very slow process.
Mm-hmm. And so what are we looking at then? What are we seeing in terms of have we seen a lot of projects, or what are we seeing there?
I think we're seeing more projects moving forward, more projects in the planning stages. I think gradually over the year it'll improve even more dramatically.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of projects are we seeing?
We're seeing the beginnings of some residential subdivisions in eastern Sussex County. We're seeing some retail development, mostly small scale. I mentioned things like the Wawa that's being built at Long Neck and Millsboro, and Rite Aids, drugstores, Dollar Generals, that kind of small retail right now. But there are some larger retail projects that are in the planning stages that could come to fruition this year.
Are we seeing an uptick in residential as opposed to a commercial, or what's that ratio like?
I think we're seeing the improvement right now is in residential, but in some areas it may just be more sales, not necessarily higher values yet.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's key that the inventories be reduced to a reasonable level in order for values to actually begin to rise. And in some areas, they've been reduced much more dramatically than in others. Some areas are still oversupplied.
What kind of areas? I think we were talking the other day about the idea that certainly the eastern portion of Sussex County seems to be doing well, is a little bit better than some of the other areas. What's going on there?
I think in those areas they had, even though it seemed like they have had a great deal of platted lots on the books, they didn't necessarily have finished lots. So they've been, with so much demand in that area, they've been able to reduce those inventories. And that's a relatively strong market that's coming back around. New developments are moving forward. Other areas of the shore are lagging behind that considerably.
Mm-hmm. And what are we seeing in terms of pricing? Are we seeing any kind of real uptick when it comes to pricing? What's going on there?
We're seeing some increases in pricing in the most prime markets.
Uh-huh.
Sure, and then smaller increases in other areas, and some areas are just sort of level at this point.
Okay, and then are we seeing any kind of percentages of an increase we're seeing?
It can vary so dramatically from market to market.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen some good increases maybe in the Lewis area. That's the demand there is particularly high.
Mm-hmm.
They've probably seen maybe 5-10%, maybe even a little bit more in lot values.
Mm-hmm.
But it really depends on the location.
And how as we move inland to, I guess, the secondary and sort of third tertiary, as it were, areas are the prices going up really more closer to the coast than the inland areas, or what are we seeing there?
They are. They're improving more along the coast, but even in an area like Salisbury, we've seen a lot more sales in 2012 and 2013, and slight average price increases, slight like 2%, 1-2%,
something like that.
Which is still promising.
So, in terms of like picking up the housing market in particular, are you seeing more sales then?
In almost every market that I've looked at on the Eastern Shore, we're seeing more sales, more unit sales.
Uh huh. Okay. I wanted to ask you, Memo, one of the big things that has been going on here has been obviously the gridlock that's occurred in Washington, and a massive major cut that's taking place in certainly federal spending from the sequester. One of the things that somebody reminded me the other day was that during the 1982 recession, one of the things that occurred there was, and one of the things that the Reagan administration did not have to worry about, was cuts in state spending, that there was actually a revenue sharing operation that actually funneled money in, so that while you had, unemployment rose up to about 10% in 1982, there was still this upsurge, this push from below in terms of state spending. How key is A, state spending to maintaining where we are, and B, how significant is trying to unlock some of the gridlock and some of the cuts, for that matter, that's occurred coming out of Washington?
If you take a 25-30-year history off the shore, what you see is that a very significant portion of our economy is fueled by federal and state spending, particularly pass-through federal spending that comes through the state. We jokingly say that the number one occupation on the shore is government-related jobs. And that's true, because even when you're looking at the healthcare sector, which is the only healthy sector that remained healthy through the recession until this year, a lot of the jobs there are because of government-funded care, Medicare, Medicaid, and other types of government-funded or subsidized care. So when you take that money out of the economy obviously suffers, because that is outside money coming in and churning internally. It has a higher multiplier effect. It has a higher economic impact on us. You take that money or reduce that money, which is what is happening, there is a negative impact. And you add to that the fact that we had the stimulus, which temporarily increased the spending here, which gave us a little bit of jolt to be able to not fall down too much. When that went away, now that that is over, right, nothing replaced it. So we're now going below standard levels, below used the levels we're used to. And the private sector, as of yet, is not picking up the slack. They're beginning to, which is why we are predicting moderate growth.
So at this point, are you optimistic that the current deals that are being struck is going to at least give some stability? But I guess the question is, we may have stability, but we still may have cuts.
Correct. And when you look at the situation now, and what's going to come down, is there's two sides of the coin. The good news is we have learned to do more with less. The bad news is that depresses wages. And since wages are what churns in the economy, that's an issue. So productivity has increased. The cost of doing a lot of business has increased. Subsequently, a lot of private sector profits have increased. So there's a lot of cash in the marketplace. If some of that cash comes back into the marketplace, we're going to be better than we are now. So the hope is that the stability that we're talking about is going to encourage business decision makers to employ some of that cash for either capacity enhancement or employment or even technology increases. That then will translate into more economic activity. Time will tell.
Now, one of the issues that also has come up is this idea about raising the minimum wage. We've certainly seen at the state level where Martin O'Malley has talked about raising it to $10.10 an hour. We're seeing some efforts to get it up in Congress. We'll see actually how that goes. Most of these minimum wages have not been raised in a number of years. I saw one statistic that said that actually the minimum wage compared to the 1960s is like about $3 below in 2014 dollars. That is, it would have been, $10 an hour back in the 1960s and 2014 dollars, but it's way less. In other words, it seems as if there's this continuing depression on wages that then obviously has to cut into demand, which creates its own problem. I mean, what do you see in terms of, A, the impact of raising, say, minimum wage, say, at the state level, And do you think there are any prospects for that to go up at the federal level?
You're absolutely right. The bigger problem here is that we haven't raised it as cost of living has increased and as productivity has increased. If you look at minimum wage, not only as inflation adjusted, but also productivity adjusted, to be able to get back to what we got for that minimum wage as output, we would have to pay $14 to $16 an hour. So clearly there is a wage depression going on in that particular sector of the economy. It is not good, because 66 to 70% of our economy depends on people spending money. And if they don't have money to spend, the economy is not going to churn. So it is a good idea. Forget the politics for one moment. Just looking at the economics, it's a good idea to have a robust middle class, robust just below middle class to be able to have that social and economic mobility to be able to encourage the economy to go to get to the next level of growth. What is going to happen? Well, yesterday at the Chamber's Economic Forecast, I was talking to a number of business owners who were saying, whatever's going to happen, I wish they would index it so that I know what's coming down. What they don't like is this uncertainty of ratcheting up at very large levels. They don't want those 14%, 15%, 16% increases. If everything is going up 2%, they want to see it going up 2% so they can predict it, they can plan for it, they can do something about it. When the difference between what it was, what it ought to be, is too large, we have this kind of political polemic going on. My recommendation to decision makers, go ahead and bite the bullet, index it, get it out of the way. Will that happen? I think it's going to happen in the state of Maryland. I don't know about the indexing, but the $10 range. Federal is a whole different ballgame.
I mean, does raising the minimum wage at the state level make us not as competitive with, say, other states? I mean, it's one thing to do it, say, on a national level, which, okay, everybody's affected, but how does that...
If I had a dollar for every time somebody said it's going to be the end of the world on any of these changes, I'd be a multimillionaire now. Yes, there will be an initial impact. Always there are winners and losers anytime you make a change. But remember what we said, when you increase the ability of people to spend, they're going to use that in the economy. So in the aggregate, over a sufficient period of adjustment, there'll be no change. It will adjust itself. It's still the same amount of money churning in the economy. What's going to be more important is creating jobs and better paying jobs and doing that economic activity. If a few small businesses say they cannot do that, you know what? They learn how to deal with that. And that's a good thing. It's a way of improving. I'm not putting down the idea that there is going to be some suffering initially, which is why I say it should be indexed instead of having these major increases. A business can absorb a 2% increase a lot easier than a 14% increase.
Because that was, well, as a matter of fact, in the governor's proposal, I think there is a proposal to not only have the jump but also have it indexed to inflation. And talking to Peter Franchot yesterday, the state controller, he said he favored it, but he was concerned about trying to create some kind of carve-outs or exemptions for some of the small businesses who might not be able to absorb it, at least in his view. Do you share that?
No, I don't.
Yeah?
Okay. I'm a 7 times entrepreneur in addition to being an academic. And this answer I'm giving to you, looking at it from an entrepreneur's perspective, if I cannot adjust to market changes, then I'm doing something wrong. And sooner or later, if it's not that reason, for another reason, I'm going to suffer. So it is to my benefit to have a seat at the table when these things are being discussed, to say that I don't want these 10%, I want the 2%. The only exemption I would favor is phasing it in for small businesses, but not exempting. Because in a final analysis, you're creating two classes of citizens, those who work for small businesses and those who don't.
George, I want to ask you. So, as you look at the real estate market, are we seeing more people coming now in than say we have in the past to buy homes? Is the housing market picking up? Are people being able to move, say, from New Jersey to here? What do you see going on in terms of people coming now to the shore? Because one of the big drivers for housing here has been the sort of the come here, the people coming. What are you seeing? And people retiring. What are you seeing?
I think that's true more so in Delaware than it is in Maryland. In Maryland, I think most of the buyers right now are still local buyers. Mm-hmm. There's a small amount of people from other areas buying, but in Delaware, it's a significant portion of the buyers.
And our lot, what? Have any sense about how many people are underwater in terms of their mortgages and so on? I mean, because that obviously affects the ability to buy another home as well as just simply mobility.
I would say that a lot of people are still underwater.
Still underwater.
Because you would have to see pretty significant increases in values to overcome what we lost.
Mm-hmm. And are we looking at this market recovery anytime soon? Or, I mean, if you're talking to a homeowner and you're looking at the housing market, is this a good time to sell, or are you telling people, hey, maybe you better wait?
Oh, I think it's a good time to buy.
You think it's bad?
I think it's a good time to buy.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is, everything, all the signs point to an improving market. So most likely if you put it off, it'll cost more later. But again, it hinges for a lot of people on being able to sell the house they have now.
Yeah. And that is that beginning to pick up then?
It is beginning to pick up, but I'm sure it's still a challenge.
Yeah, yeah. The other thing, by the way, before we leave the segment, I wanted to talk about, we heard, not that it's anybody's specialty, but we heard a lot about the agriculture sector and a lot about the phosphorus regulations and the fight over that. Remember, how do you see agriculture faring in terms of this area? Because one of the questions becomes, as we put more and more regulations on farmers and on the poultry industry, that ultimately can make you not as competitive, say, what in other areas that don't necessarily have to have those kinds of regulations, those kinds of restrictions. How are you assessing the agriculture sector?
Well, the there's a certain level of paranoia going on, and if people are really out to get you, it's not always paranoia. Secretary Buddy Hass of the Maryland Department of Agriculture said it best yesterday. Those Marylanders who are pushing these regulations number in the, just in one organization alone, number in the 100,000. The farmers, when they all come together and agree with each other, they're about 10,000. So there is a political tug of war going on here. And there are legitimate concerns from the agriculture sector. What they're saying is, do not single us out. Do not solve the entire environment problem on our backs, forgetting what's happening in the stormwater issues and municipal runoff issues and sewer treatment facilities on the other side of the bay. They're right, because 60% of the problem is actually on the other side of the bay, but almost 90% of all the solutions are here on this side of the bay. And there's a certain illogic to that, as well as unfairness.
Explain that to us. How does that work?
Most of the regulatory pressures are coming from environmental groups, which are actually doing good things for good reasons. But they have in themselves admitted that the low-hanging fruit, the path of least resistance, is fixing the agriculture side of things. In this process, what's happening is the agriculture sector is seeing a non-ending barrage of rules and regulations and changes and cost increases without any kind of compensation. They see it almost like a taking. The other part is there's no acknowledgement for the improvements the ag sector have made in the past 20 to 25 years. And they're still the bad guys, having made so many improvements. So they're saying, let's have a seat at the table, talk these things together. Let's look at the totality of the problem and share some of the burden. And if there's going to be something that we need to do that is going to put us at a disadvantage compared to our neighboring states, i.e. Delaware or Virginia, then let's find some kind of mechanism to protect us in the marketplace. Because if you put us at a disadvantage, then we go away. And that is right. I believe what is going to happen is, for the phosphorus tool, it is coming back, but there's so much pressure now to do an economic impact study that is going to happen. The question is how that study is done and what does it show, and you know, how can it be used? I really understand, having lived here now 25 years, the plight of the ag sector. I understand how important they are to the economy. And what I do not understand is the insistence to treat them the way the state of Maryland is treating them. You don't treat goose that lays the golden egg this way. Yet, you know, this is what's happening.
Why do you think that is? That's
not an economic question. That's a political question. The reality is politics. Yeah. It is politics. When you have an organization such as the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, which I admire it tremendously, and the leadership there I admire, but the reality is they have to deal with their membership base, which is west of the Bay membership base, and they want a beautiful Chesapeake Bay, a pristine blue, clean Chesapeake Bay. They want the oysters to come back and all of that stuff. We all do. And somehow, somewhere along the line, they said it is cheaper and easier to get the farmers to clean up than when we have the ability, we'll deal with the bigger problems. It's gonna take a lot of education. Unfortunately, we neither have the clout nor the resources to be able to educate the city folk on the other side of the bay that, yes, there had been a problem. Yes, we've been dealing with it, and we're going to continue to deal with it. But please, please, please stop slapping us.
How does one gauge the value of, say, an economic impact as opposed to an environmental impact. And one of the things that struck me is that if we want, say, to have chickens grown on the Eastern Shore, might that, if we say we want to continue that, might we need some kind of financial assistance from the state, i.e. through the taxpayers, in order to maintain that industry if indeed we want it to continue? And how does one trade off, say, an economic benefit as opposed to, say, an environmental benefit?
Well, you've heard about that road paved with good intentions.
Right.
These measures that are being forced upon the ag sector are actually good measures, and over time they ought to be happening. But there are unintended consequences when you try to do too much too soon and only in just one geographic area on the eastern shore of Maryland. You're not looking at the rest of the Delmarva Peninsula. You're not looking at what's happening up in Pennsylvania. So you're trying to put a Band-Aid on a bigger problem, and you want only that part of the geography to pay for the Band-Aid. That part is illogical. From an economic impact perspective, all environmental benefit over time is economically beneficial. But you need to look at the cost benefit of that, not only over time, but also now. Who pays for it? Who benefits from it? Who is going to have to suffer from it? Can we mitigate that suffering? So we need to have more a sort of an aggregate look at things, and then we need to look at the micro level. What happens to this farmer that is now going to, who's living on very uncertain and small margins, is going to have to take this additional burden when their competitor in the marketplace, only 10 miles north to them, doesn't have to. So it requires a good analysis, and we're hoping that this good analysis is going to be undertaken in the very near future to be able to answer these questions. What they proposed to do, the way they proposed to do it, was beyond illogical. It just didn't make sense.
We've been speaking with Dr. Memo Derriker. He's head of the Business Economic and Community Outreach Network at Salisbury University, also president-elect of the Salisbury Area Chamber of Commerce. Also, Georgia Nichols, who is the Assistant Managing Director for Integra Realty Resources. Appreciate you both coming in. Coming up next after the break, we're going to take a look at Somerset County and a piece of its unique history. That's coming up. I'm Don Rush. You're listening to Delmarva Public Radio. Somerset County has a motto, Semper Idem, meaning always the same. And if there's any county on the lower shore that people say is slow and changing, it is Somerset County. I'm Don Rush. Welcome back to Delmarva Today. And the complex cross currents between social tensions, racial tensions that finally, of course, result in the first African American to join the county commissioners just within the last decade, to the good old boy network, has often found the county at odds with economic growth. I want to take a look, a rather unique look, actually, at this county's history. And in our studio is Meredith Ramsey. She is author of the book, Community, Culture, and Economic Development, Continuity and Change in Two Small Southern Towns. And well, first of all, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Don. Pleasure to be here.
One of the things the thing that really struck me, this was actually a study you did, I think it was in the late 80s, I think it was.
Yes, that's when I began it, yes.
And give me a sense first about the origin, because it seems to me the origin of Somerset County, as you lay it out, really begins to lay out the problems that it has, as opposed to maybe even like Worcester County or even Wicomico County.
Yes, indeed. excuse me, when I first began this research, my research question was, why is one city, Crisfield, is very ambivalent mm-hmm. about economic development, whereas there is a group in Princess Anne that is about the same size, same economic conditions, that is actively pursuing economic development? And I didn't understand. I wanted to understand the difference. How do you explain it? So what I discovered was that the only way I could explain it was to go back as early as the 17th century mm-hmm. and look at the history of the county, the social structures that developed, and the culture that was a part of it. What I found was that in the 1600s, the first part of Somerset County that was settled, that is to say, with the exception of the Akahanok tribe, which is originally here, the first people to come from elsewhere were called the Picaroons. Mm-hmm. And they settled the water, the waterways bordering the bay. The area around Crisfield, Deal Island, Chance, in that area. And they were, the Picaroons were pirates. They were runaway slaves, escaping slave, runaway mm-hmm. indentured servants. And these were people who had no land, no way to buy land or acquire land. They got their living off the abundance of the Chesapeake Bay, hunting, fishing. And that became the way of life in that part of the county, which what we call, I call South County,
right,
where Crisfield is. And then the, on the other hand, Princess Anne, which is inland, is the county seat. Princess Anne does not border the bay. It's fully landlocked, so to speak, and it was settled by people with land grants from the king, people who became planters, growers, as they call them, and they brought with them indentured servants in the earliest days and began growing tobacco, later cotton. Mm-hmm. And so it's a completely different economy as well as a completely different social structure. In Princess Anne, the agricultural area, it was a hierarchical society. There were the plantation owners, and there were the indentured servants, and then later there were slaves, black slaves from Africa, and very little crossover, shall we say, between these elements. Very hierarchical, and that, in a way, continues. In Crisfield, on the other hand, these were people, and the people who live there now are their descendants, who've lived there for many, many, many years. They have no interest in developing land. They don't own land much, not very much. They make their living by fishing, crabbing, oystering, and that means all of the sectors of the seafood industry. That includes the seafood packers, the seafood pickers,
right,
and the watermen themselves, the fishermen. Now, they are very poor. They have always been poor. And they've developed a very unique culture of their own. I call it a subsistence culture. It's very egalitarian, quite opposite to the Princess Anne area in that respect. Very egalitarian, although there are limits to that,
right. Yeah, of course.
It's a community that is not really interested in acquiring wealth. They are not able to acquire it themselves, particularly in recent decades with the decline of the bay, the catch in the bay, and the decline of the seafood industry. And they have an ethos of never appearing to have or having more than their neighbors, because that could threaten the cohesion of the community, could create jealousies and competition and that sort of thing. The people there, they feel that they depend on each other every day, for not just for their livelihood, but for their survival out on the bay, where they are in many ways at the mercy of forces, great forces of nature outside of their control.
Let me ask you this. I'll turn to it particularly when you're talking about Crisfield. There was an effort, the chamber wanted to redevelop. There was a mayor, Richard Scott, as a matter of fact,
right,
who was, I guess, a man of the earth, a man of the people, as it were. Tell me a little bit about that and how that really sort of exemplifies this resistance. Because, I mean, you talk about a particular meeting with the chamber, and the chamber said, well, why can't we do this and why don't we do that? And they said, why should we? I mean, tell me a little bit about that conversation that took place.
Yes. The Chamber of Commerce in Crisfield held a series of breakfasts with the city council to discuss how they could bring about more development. And I attended one of those meetings, and Mayor Scott, and not just Mayor Scott, but other of the members of the city council, gave some very interesting answers. And the president of the chamber asked the group, what are you doing with that vacant property down on the other side of, next to the bay, beyond the marina? And the answer came, we're planning to develop subsidized housing there. And the chamberman almost swallowed his teeth.
Right.
He literally expostulated, saying, what? That's not the highest and best use of the land. The mayor explained that funds to develop had been allocated by the federal government.
Right.
Anyway, another thing that occurred at that particular meeting that I found very telling was that a real estate developer, Harvey Hastings, a realtor and a developer, petitioned the mayor and the council to evict a gentleman by the name of Reverend Best, evict him from the old abandoned arcade theater in downtown Crisfield, because Mr. Hastings' client wanted to tear down the theater and put up something new in that place. And the mayor's response to me said everything. He said, we're not going to do that, sir. There are, in this community, we don't put a man out on the street. There are other ways to handle the problem. We're not going to put someone out on the street weeks before Christmas. We'll find a way to handle it, but we will not evict Reverend Best. And I've never heard, you know, anyone talk that way before. I was very touched, very moved, and it gave me a respect. It gave me a real respect for the people of Crisfield.
And yet, at the same time, what we're seeing that very attitude then though inhibits growth. I mean, there's this sense of keeping it, like the egalitarianism and the rest of it. At the same time, because when I walk down in Crisfield today, and you know, it's been hit by a number of things, but it's a very empty town. That there's not. I mean, there was apparently a Phoenix idea that they were going to revitalize the town and so on, but that didn't happen. And it seems as if, even as egalitarian as it is, the town has diminished. I mean,
has diminished. I don't know how much of that diminution can be attributed to the local mindset, because they had a terrible fire in downtown Crisfield in 1987, I believe it was, and from which they never fully recovered. And then there came the real estate boom, and developers came in and built hundreds of apartments and townhouses for people from the outside to come, who wanted to come and, you know, do sailing and so forth in Crisfield. And then almost immediately, as soon as these buildings had gone up, came the real estate crash of 2008. And many of those, I understand that many of those townhouses stand empty to this day. And those that did sell, many sold for less than half of their original price. So there's been these forces. There have certainly been major forces, economic and geographic. Then, of course, there was Hurricane Sandy.
Right.
More recently. That did terrible damage to Crisfield. But what was the role, you're asking me, what was the role of this mentality?
Yeah.
Here's the way I came to understand it from their perspective. Mm-hmm. They are poor. They're poor people. And they're very proud, and they're very independent, and they're very hardworking. And they love their city. They don't want to leave. They really would have nowhere else to go. And their fear is that if development came to Crisfield, and there have been efforts to develop it, a wealthy hunting club, for example, but the way the people see it is, well, if that happens, then the people are going to demand zoning changes and code changes. People won't be able to afford that. Taxes will go up. Property values will go up. People will become go into arrears. They will lose their homes. And where will they go? It will increase competition for everything. And we just don't want to become servants to the super rich. And you know, realistically, I think there may be a lot to what they say. Now, this raises a really important question that I rarely hear addressed by anyone. And that is, when you're talking about a town, a community, a city, do you mean the physical place with its buildings and roads, or do you mean the people who live there? And if you mean the people who live there, do you mean the people who live there now, or the people who will come and displace those who live there now. Maybe.
You know, what's interesting is that you get that, but as you point out, Princess Anne is almost seems like the reverse. As you indicate, as a matter of fact, you indicate that you know, because it's a landed issue, decline in agriculture and lots of other factors, people began to say, okay, we're going to get into land development.
Exactly.
And one of the things that struck me, particularly about the tale of Princess Anne during this second half of the 80s, is how people who would hold government positions would be sitting around, turning around, and voting on the very investments that they had their money in. I mean, explain how this worked. I mean, most of the people, as a matter of fact, you describe in the book during that period, now seem to be gone. But nonetheless, there's this whole real estate annexation stuff that went on, whether or not the residents wanted it or not.
That's right. Well, what happened was that the planters, the plantation owners, as they used to be called, the landowners, began to experience a severe decline in the agricultural industry and were no longer able to make the kind of living at it that they wanted. And they saw a continuing decline. And so this real estate entrepreneur, I would call him, Mr. Hastings, mm-hmm. moved to town.
Right.
And organized the ruling group, I'll call them,
mm-hmm.
Organized them to begin to think about developing their land and really kind of giving up on agriculture, but putting in housing developments, for example, and developing the town as much as possible to bring commerce and more housing that would be needed and so forth. So they saw it as being very much in their economic interest to bring in development. Now, many people in Princess Anne are poor and are not landowners, but they are not the ruling group. Historically, and really right until today, the people who have made the major decisions in that town are a handful of families who are landowners, whose ancestors were slave owners, who always depended in this hierarchical society, always depended on a captive labor force or a cheap labor force, and they continue to rule. I have to use that word, rule. These are the kinds of terms that I have been told in my interviews with people. There are certain families that are born to rule here. And there's a great deal of nepotism. There's a great deal of conflict of interest, as you observed. These same people are the ones who want to develop their agricultural lands, and they are the ones who occupy all of the major public offices in Somerset County, actually, not just in Princess Anne. Historically, they have opposed development, and some still do, because they want to keep a cheap labor force. They don't want industries coming in that would pay a higher wage and force them to pay a higher wage. And how they get away with it is a good question. Well, I think it has a lot to do with the isolation of Somerset County.
Although they have this thing called the Economic Development Commission, I think it is.
Yeah.
I've interacted with them. I remember there was a big booster for a ferry that would go from, say, Crisfield to Virginia. You seem to indicate that it was created and it did all these things, but there was a lot of resistance to it, nonetheless. I mean, they seem to be trying to do two different things at odds with one another.
That's right. There was a great resistance to it. And I think, I can't say it speaks so much about the Economic Development Council of the county, yeah. but in Princess Anne, for example, they saw it. There was a group that tried hard to bring in development, and what did they bring in? They brought in a stinking clam plant.
That's a bad idea.
Yeah, and the gases and odors from the runoff water from it were coming seeping into the public library, into people's homes. People were becoming sick. Eventually, it was forced to close. It was putting an untenable strain on the sewer system. Even the prison that they brought in used up all the water.
It was a few jobs, I take it.
There were a few jobs, and the jobs that came were state jobs, and they paid higher than the Princess Anne Police Force could pay. So Princess Anne had to, in order to retain any police force, had to double their wages to compete with the prison. So, you know, as the gentleman who was here before, he said, it's very, very complex. I mean, there are so many trade-offs. It seems that for anybody who stands to gain, somebody else stands to lose, at least in the way they're going about it.
Mm-hmm. I want to turn, by the way, to the issue of race, which is just underlines this place. There was a few years back, there was a study done, and basically African Americans, they were like very small percentage of the county, for instance, the county workers, nothing in the upper ranges.
Right.
And led to that. What is race relations all about in that county? Why does it seem to, at least until recently anyway, seem to have been at a standstill?
Well, in some ways it may still be at a standstill. I'm not sure, but there certainly has been progress made in terms of overcoming the disenfranchisement of African Americans in the county, and there's a lot of hope, you know, that things will eventually change. But as I have been told by members of the NAACP, for example, hearts haven't changed. The rules have changed. The laws have changed. But there still is a very strong strand of racism that runs through the county. I'm not saying that everyone, by any means, is of those persuasions, but it's certainly strong. And why? Again, I have to say, I think it has a lot to do with the geography of Somerset County. It is the southernmost county in Maryland. It is down at the very boot of the eastern shore of Maryland. And until the Bay Bridge was built in the 1950s, the only way to get there was by boat over the Chesapeake. And consequently, they were sort of able to do what they pleased. People who didn't like it left. And those who stayed, you know, do not want it to change.
You describe the map. You describe a situation where if someone spoke out, who was an African American, spoke out, that the community is so small that there would be repercussions.
Oh yes, repercussions. Yes, and I think it's important to note that those who have spoken out, and those who have taken, you know, real steps. For example, initiating the study that you referred to,
right.
They were people whose jobs were not vulnerable. Some were employed at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore, UMES, and they were not going to lose their jobs if they spoke out on behalf of the black community. others were afraid to. And probably with good reason, based on, you know, some things I observed. The status quo was maintained by threats, intimidation, and that is still occurring to a certain extent, not only to keep African Americans in place, in their so-called place, but also anyone who bucks the system, whether it be outsiders who've retired to Princess Anne or anyone. There was an election in Princess Anne, for example, to the town commission back in 1990, an electoral uprising against the regime, and the people elected a woman for the first time in history, a black for the first time in history, a man who was gay, and a man who was a retired biochemist from New Jersey. They wanted, you know, a new beginning there. But those people were driven out one after another, except for the African-American. And he is still in office. As a matter of fact, right now, he's the president
right.
of the town commission. And and good for him. But the woman was driven to resign by actions that were taken against her son. The gay man was resigned because of a campaign of really ugly bigotry that was in which the local press cooperated in publishing these columns that were thinly veiled attacks on the man who lived at the corner of Sodom and Gomorrah, as they said.
Hmm.
He resigned, and the man from the biochemist from New Jersey became the head of the, eventually became head of the zoning board in Princess Anne, and when he opposed the clam plant.
Hmm.
Not just the clam plant, but when he opposed these developments of trailer parks and whatnot all around, they simply overruled him and did what they wanted to do. And
let me ask you this: do you think that? I mean, how much do you think has changed? Because the study that you did, late 80s, I think it was around 1990 or so, and you've been back, you say that clearly there's a lot of good things that have happened in Princess Anne, certainly in terms of development and so on.
Yeah.
But has a system changed, do you think?
Certainly not to a great extent. The members of the same family, their in-laws, their brothers, they occupy all of the major positions, like the county administrator, for example. They move from one job to another, and it's monopolized by these few families, mostly farmers. Some of them are merchants. Some are lawyers. And that continues. Now, as I say, as you said, and I agree, that the black community has been able to bring about electoral change.
Right, first member of the
very
the
first
county county
very first county commissioner. And let me say, when that happened, the blacks in Somerset County accounted for 42% of the population, but none had ever been elected to the county commission in the 350 years since that county was founded, until 2010.
All right. As a matter of fact, we'll have to wrap this up, but as a matter of fact, and that was even despite the fact that there had actually been a piece of the county, a district carved out for African-American representation.
That's right.
And
right.
It didn't happen until later. We've been speaking with Meredith Ramsey. Her book is Community, Culture, and Economic Development, Continuity and Change in Two Small Southern Towns. And, of course, really an interesting look at Somerset County if you want to get a sense about some of its history. You've been listening to Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush, and thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Our volunteer producers are Penny Hartman, Kathleen Grout, and Jim White. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC14.org.